Welcome to Making Way Podcast, a podcast about finding your own path in life. We're sharing stories to encourage you to live your life how you want to live it and not how you're supposed to. Part of finding our path in life is finding ourselves. Ourself can be marred by the hurts and trauma we've experienced. Trauma is a word we hear a lot these days. Well, what is trauma? According to Gabor Mate, a physician and world-renowned trauma expert, explains, trauma is from the Greek word for wound. It's not what happens to you, it is what happens inside of you as a result of what happens to you. It's not the blow on the head, but the concussion I get. As we get older, it may feel like it's too late to change. In this powerful episode, we have the privilege of hearing the incredible story of Eva Chapman. Eva's life is a tapestry woven with rich experiences from deep trauma to the joys she has found along the way. Her journey serves as a testament to resilience and a powerful reminder that it's never too late to find healing and fulfillment. Born in Prague, Eva escaped Czechoslovakia with her Ukrainian mother, Olga, and made a new home in Australia in 1950. Throughout her life, Eva has pursued a variety of careers, including teaching and psychotherapy, eventually earning a PhD in 1986. In 2006, Eva published her first book, Sasha and Olga. She has since published books such as Butterflies and Demons, From Russia to Love, and her latest publication, Sexy at 70. In this episode, Eva shares her remarkable journey, highlighting the importance of resilience, self-discovery, and finding healing. From overcoming trauma to pursuing a fulfilling career as an author, Eva's story serves as a beacon of hope and possibility. I hope you enjoy this episode. Start off at the beginning, which is, where are you from?
Oh, I was born in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic it was called then. My mother was a Ukrainian refugee from Stalin and from Germany because she'd been forced to be a prisoner of war for the Germans. And after the war, she wanted to go back to her homeland in the Ukraine. But everybody at the border said, go back, go back. Stalin would just send you to a labor camp because you were in the West. You know, you were with the Germans, so you are not a good person to have here. So she escaped and went down into Czechoslovakia and ended up working in my real father's house as a maid. But my real father's family were quite wealthy and they hated her and they hated the communists and they hated the fact that she was there, and they didn't like her at all. But she got pregnant with me, and that made it even worse. And so eventually they I had the baby in hospital, and then my mother had a postnatal depression and went into hospital somewhere, and I think my father's parents looked after me, but I don't know. And but I remember I was 9 months old when I saw this woman in the street, and I thought, God, she looks familiar. And it was my mother coming out of the hospital. And I told her about this later in life, and she said, well, you were only 9 months old. I'm amazed you remember that. Yeah, you know, she found it difficult to reconnect with me.
But yeah, how is that possible at such a young age? Like,
I know, that's my earliest, one of my earliest memories, yes. I think it's because it's so dramatic. Because I remember the boat trip to Australia when I was three, very dramatic. I remember escaping across the Czechoslovakian border into Austria with motorbike patrols, you know, Russian troops on motorbikes searching through the forest. I remember all that very vividly. And so my poor mother had a terrible time, and then my father's parents wanted to keep me and tell her to go away. And eventually she ran away with me to the south of Czechoslovakia and went across the border, escaped that, and we went into Austria. And then we pretty well walked to Italy where there were ships. And she wanted to go to America, but they wouldn't take single woman with a child. So they we went to Australia. So that's how I got to Australia. It's quite a dramatic story.
What were you like as a kid?
I there was a lot of prejudice against me. Australians were very British. I went to Adelaide, which was like a small Britain, really. And they didn't want refugees. They didn't want migrants. And they looked down upon us. I had a funny name. Nobody could ever pronounce it. And so I had a pretty hard time growing up with that sort of prejudice against me. And but then, you know, I went to school and I went to high school and I went to university and I left when I was 24, when my daughter was 5 weeks old. And we went to Paris. It's an English teacher. So yeah.
So did you go to university while you were in Australia?
Yes, I did. I went to Adelaide University. And I did English and history, and I was a teacher. And
I mean, at that point when you're at university, why did you choose to study English? What were you hoping? Did you think of having a career going to university at that point?
Well, when I was a child, one of the things that I was very good at was learning English really fast and learning how to spell, how to read, all that sort of stuff. And my teacher would be always saying, "This little girl's not even Australian or English, and she writes and speaks much better than you." So I don't know if that was a good thing. So I used to get a lot of praise from my teachers for being so good at English, and I think that's why I wanted to be an English teacher, you know, and in history. I loved history as well.
And, so then how did you decide to go to Paris? And
My first husband was a historian, and he was doing a thesis on the French Revolution. And so he was going there for 3 years to do that. And so I got a job as an assistant in a French lycée while he was doing that.
Well, what was that experience like?
It was difficult being in Paris as a young mother with a small child. I mean, I knew French. I did French university. Learning French and speaking French when everybody was speaking it so fast was much more difficult. And so I had a very hard time. And my husband was in this school where a lot of people were learning English. And there were people from Libya and Turkey and all sorts of places. They always to come around every night while I was breastfeeding. And a lot of them started fighting with knives. It was very, very traumatic. And it was a time of Arab riots in the street. It was 71. And there was a lot of problems with demonstrations and things like that. Yeah. So it wasn't easy.
At that point in your life, do you have a vision or some sort of, maybe not vision's not the right word, but kind of like a North Star in terms of how you wanted to create your life?
By that time, I knew that I wanted to leave my husband.
Oh, wow.
We weren't very happy together. But I was very attached to his parents. They were wonderful. They were like my second parents because my father wasn't speaking to me. My mother was in a mental hospital. She went in when I was about 13. So I didn't have a proper home life. So his parents became my parents, and they loved me and I loved them, and I was staying because of them, you know. So it was a difficult decision to leave him because it meant leaving that family. But they never let me go. They always loved me until they died. And they fell in love with my husband, who you just met. Because I was married a second time as well to a man that they didn't like. But then I married my third husband, and I said, "Oh, at last you have found your prince."
Oh.
And so they loved him very much as well. So it all ended up all right. So my vision, I didn't know. I just knew that I had to leave my husband, and I didn't know how I was going to do that. And it all came up in 72, 73, when I started to do encounter groups. I did encounter groups with these people from America.
What's that? What's an encounter group?
An encounter, well, it was a 48-hour marathon. That's what it used to be called. The group started at midnight and went till midnight Sunday with 5 hours sleep. An encounter group is where you confront people. You get angry, you shout, you scream, all that sort of stuff.
What is the purpose of this?
The purpose of this is to get rid of your emotion, is to deal with your emotions and confront what, you know, what's going on in your life. It was very good, but it was quite brutal. And eventually I got into running other kinds of groups, and I ended up running what's called an enlightenment intensive, which is a very different group to an encounter group, where you don't confront people at all. They have to find out for themselves, which suited me a lot better.
Mm.
However, it learning experience.
Huh? Yeah. Did those groups help you?
They did. They did. Because I was very shy. I was very screwed up about my mother. And so there was a lot of crying about her and dealing with that. It's really hard to deal with a mother who's schizophrenic and a father who's rejected you and two sisters who you never see because your father doesn't, my father doesn't want me to see them. Yeah, it was tough. So I had to deal with all that in therapy. I did lots of therapy and lots of looking at myself and trying to heal my past. Yeah.
I mean, how did you reconcile those feelings about, you know, your mom and your father and kind of, you know, feeling the pain you were feeling? Like, how did you then work through those?
Well, the biggest reconciliation came when I was in my 40s, and I thought, and I was very happily married now to Jake, and I thought, well, I have to heal my family. You know, I just have to find out what's going on. My mother was dead by now. She died when I was about 30. And so I wrote to my father and said I wanted to write a book about my mother, which actually wasn't true because I wasn't a writer, but it was a way in. So I went to see him, and he was already in hospital with quite bad cancer, and we reconciled. We reconciled. It was a beautiful reconciliation, and his big tragedy in life was just having a mentally ill mother and then two mentally ill daughters. Both my sisters were mentally ill as well. I escaped somehow. No, I escaped because I really worked hard on myself. I really worked hard on dealing with all the demons, because there were a lot of demons, and that's what I was dealing with. And so I faced all that.
What do you think? Why do you think that sets you apart from your sisters? Like, how come you... Do you ever think about, like, why you were able to deal with your demons while your sister struggled to do that?
I think I had more of my mother's love, even though she was already, and they both had postnatal depression really severely. They both had children and postnatal depression, which just was bad for them. I didn't have it. All I had was being in a strange country in Paris and not being able to speak the language with a baby. But I survived that, and I never had. I had two children. I never had postnatal depression. So why that happened to me, I don't know. So that was partly why I was going back and trying to find things out and trying to, you know, talk about it to my father. And he was great. He was really, really great. And Jake, my husband, really helped me, because I was so angry and despairing about my father. He just hated me. He kicked me. No, he didn't kick me out. I ran away. I mean, it was pretty bad. And so Jake would often role play being my father, and it was really, really good. So I could work out a lot of stuff with him, and he supported me in going to Australia a lot to help my father as he was dying. And that's when my father told me his sad story. And so I wrote that sad story and my mother's sad story and my story all in my first book, Sasha and Olga, which came out in about 2006. And so I say to anybody you're never too late to start writing. And writing has been a wonderful thing for me to put it all down, to actually put the history down. I found it difficult writing the story of my mother because I felt I don't want to betray her. I don't want to say bad things about her. But she was very cruel to me, and I had to face that and I had to say it. And I think I found a way of saying it, which with compassion. And that is really the secret, is compassion. You have to forgive her for all those things because she couldn't help it. Well, I don't know. I have a difficulty with that. I don't know if people who've got schizophrenia can help it or not. You know,
yeah. So it's
really, really difficult.
Well, I wonder, I mean, hearing the sad stories of your parents, because I feel like something that does happen, you know, hopefully this happens for people as they get older, is that you can start to detach your parents from just being mom and dad and kind of see them as separate people. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is a really good thing about getting older. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're people and they suffer. And well, the best thing in my life that I, one of the best things I've done in my life is to heal my relationship, a 33-year-old split with my stepfather. And it was very, very beautiful. And I'm glad I did it. So, but it was hard. I had to do a lot of work on myself. I had to, you know, face all my demons. I feel at least I did that, you know.
You don't have to give us the details, but, you know, so many of us are, you know, have our own struggles and maybe some things that feels like we can't overcome. Can you just kind of maybe give us, like, I don't know, what a little bit of insight of what it looks like to heal yourself?
A lot of crying. A lot of facing blame. A lot of blaming, wanting to blame her or wanting to blame him, and facing that and seeing where that comes from, dealing with those emotions, going through a lot of the traumas. I did a lot of screaming, a lot of crying. It's not easy, and not many people want to do it. But I would say, yes, just do it. And encounter groups were a really good way to deal with all this stuff, because that's why people came. And especially in England, in England, people really do repress their emotions. And so that was a good place for people to come to. And I had a double thing with emotions because my mother was always screaming. She was screaming in the street. She was screaming in the shops. She was just screaming. And I thought screaming is bad. So it took me a long time to think it was all right to scream. Mm. So like every time I came home from school, the house would be full of broken dishes because she would go into a rage and just chuck things everywhere. You know, so it was pretty heavy. So it's like really difficult. And one of the upshots of writing Sasha and Olga is I wanted to go to the Ukraine and find my family and to find out, is there anybody else had schizophrenia? What else was going on and all that sort of stuff? And by a huge series of coincidences, I found them. I went to Ukraine as an energy efficiency advisor because that was my job at the time. My husband and I were running an energy efficiency business to help people with insulation to keep all the heat in the house rather than letting it into the atmosphere. And so I went to Ukraine as an energy efficiency advisor, but also I thought, well, I'd really like to find my family. And I knew they came from Poltava. So I went to Poltava and talked to the mayor there, and it was a very boring meeting about energy efficiency, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, I'm looking for my mother. They all burst into tears, all of them, the mayor and all his buddies. They burst into tears and they hugged me and said, ah, Zemlyaka, which means country woman, welcome home. So they put the story in the paper, and about 4 months later I got a letter saying a distant cousin of mine recognised the photo and they knew all about my mother and they invited me to come there. And so that was a big trip that I did, going to meet my relatives, and it was very, very sad because they were all the last time they had seen Olga, my mother, was when she was being shoved into a cattle truck by the Nazis and being sent off. She was 17 years old and being sent off to Germany to work as a slave for the Reich. And so they were very, very happy to see me, and it was very, very emotional. There was no schizophrenia in the family. And they said to me, look, she was on her own. You know, she'd been traumatized by the war. She wanted to come back home to be with her mother and everybody, and she couldn't. So no wonder she went mad. You know,
sort
of their image. So it was a very useful, lovely thing to see. I mean, they're all being bombed now in various parts of Ukraine. I mean, it's terrible. And I have been helping a bit because I've been helping this bloke who has a truck, and he goes and takes all the wounded soldiers off the front lines and take them to hospital, and his truck broke down, so I helped raise some money for his truck. So that's the way I'm trying to help Ukraine, but it's just really, really sad.
Yeah, I mean, what was that experience like for you to meet your mother's family? Like, do you remember, like, what was going through your mind when you found them?
It was beautiful going to the village that she was born in, and to see where, because she used to tell me stories, you know, about her and her five brothers and sisters all sleeping on top of the bread oven because it was so cold, and only having one pair of boots to go to the outside toilet and coming back. So I could see all that, you know. And the person whose house I was in was my mother's aunt, and she was amazing. I mean, she escaped the Germans twice. She was taken away too, she walked back to Ukraine, and then I was taken away again and walked back. Extraordinary. I mean, they're just all extraordinary, extraordinary people. And they were just so happy to see me. It was lovely.
Gosh, that's just listening to that right now, it's just so heartbreaking because, you know, it's not that long ago to think about it. And I just can't believe that people, you know, live through things like that, and that people treat each other like, I mean, they still do to this day.
And the trouble is that it's long lasting, these traumas.
Yeah.
You know, when I told you that I wrote a book called Sasha and Old, which was published in Australia. And so many of the people who read it were people like me whose parents had escaped from war-torn Europe. There were 60 million refugees, you know, in 1948 or whatever. A lot of them went to Australia. And a lot of them became mentally ill. I just had a letter last week from a woman who just found my book in Canberra. She said, this is the story of my mother and my grandmother. I want them to read it. But my mother's got macular degeneration, and she only wants a podcast. She only wants audio. So I'm thinking of doing it on audio. So I said to her, why don't you go and read it to her? And she said, no, my relationship with my mother's broken down. And I can't heal it. And so I asked her, you don't have to tell me, but could you like to tell me a bit about it? I haven't heard from her since. It's really sad. So that's why it lasts. That was World War II. And it's still, the repercussions in the family are still going on. You know, there's still divisions, there's still hatred, there's still misery. It's awful. And I can see now in Ukraine, it's another 100 years of pain and misery that is happening.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, so after you went back to Ukraine and you found your family, and I guess what happened after that experience?
I went back a few times because I made really close friends with a woman called Lena. She was another energy efficiency advisor who I met in Kharkiv. And it was hilarious because we totally connected straight away, even though we had all interpreters and stuff like that, and just loved each other. And these energy efficiency stuff was all just not important. And she invited me to her dacha, and so I went, and I just fell in love with her family and they fell in love with me. And we went back several times. They were bombed terribly in Kharkiv just last year, really bad. And they managed to escape to near Poland. We invited them over. We said, look, you come with us. We'll get you visas and all that sort of stuff. And can't leave our parents, the old mother and the old father. They're, you know, on all the sides, they couldn't leave their parents. And you know, it's just, they just, and they really want to stay and fight the Russians. They really do. They're really fighting for their democracy, for their life, and trying to help as much as they can. But they don't want to come here. They don't want to leave it. They don't want to leave this school, you know.
It's their home, yeah.
So after that, I wrote the book, Sashonovka, because meeting my relatives, all that sort of healing that went on. And then I realized I really like writing. So the next book I wrote was called Butterflies and Demons, which is a story about the Adelaide Aborigines.
Well, how did you start? How did you even start writing? Like, why did you think to write a book?
Oh, when I was talking with my father and he was telling me his stories, I was recording it all. And I really, and he said to me, please write about my parents, because that they were sent off to a concentration camp in 1942. And he went looking for them, but they had died. And he said, I really want people to know about them. So I described them and talked about them. And it was like I wanted to pass on that history to other people, and because it was important. My father is important to me, and important for a lot of people who've read it. So, you know, so I loved writing when I was a teenager. I did love writing. Then I went to university, and English at university put me off reading, put me off writing for about the next 25 years. It was so badly taught, you know, really badly taught. You had to do things in a prescribed way. So I had to get out of that and just thought, yeah, I can write. So I did, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. Yeah, so that's why I started writing, was because I wanted to get that across about my parents.
Right. So the first book was Sasha and Olga.
Yeah. And then I did the research for the second book, which was a story about my life again. It's about a little Russian girl who goes to Australia and is confronts all the racism and all that sort of stuff, and about a little girl in 1840s Adelaide, Aboriginal girl, who has to go through the whole thing of the British Empire totally snuffing them away, you know. And I did a lot of research. I was a historian as well, because, you know, I did history. So I went to some really good archives and found some fantastic history and conversations that these Aborigines had with some the white people. And yeah, it's a really good book. So it's like a parallel story between my life in the 1950s and their lives in the 1840s. Yeah, so.
I mean,
that was a very healing book for me to write. So yeah. And my book, that's the thing. That's what I found, is that my stories are healing for me. You
know? Right.
And for people who read them, because I'm talking about really, really hard things and how you can get right through them. Yeah.
What is the aspect of writing a book that's so healing for you?
I always have to confront something when I write. And in this book, I had to confront my racism.
I mean, what I'm hearing is really the theme is for your healing is to really confront the experiences you had. But like, what I want to know is, like, all these years, like, I don't know what kept you going? Like, and how did you keep, I don't know, like, keep pushing through or keep looking for the goodness and things?
My last book that I wrote was called Sexy at 70. And when I was in my 60s, 50s, in my menopause, I went through a bad time. I felt, oh, I'm getting old and what's left, and so it was pretty bad. And so I wrote 60 at 70 in order to face what I was going through, and I made it. But after I finished the book, in my 70s, it was really hard. I thought, oh, it's okay going up to 70, but, you know, 70s, you're really on the downhill stretch now. Not, you know, I'm 76 now, and so what I think what keeps me going now is my husband. He's amazing. And my spiritual practice and my grandchildren and my children. My grandchildren are amazing. And I had another hard time with them. My first grandchild died at 2 days old. So that was terrible for my daughter. I mean, my daughter heard the whole history of my family and postnatal depression, so she was a bit worried. But then he died at 2 days old. She said, this is a lot worse than post. He said, I'm not going to have postnatal depression. I want a live baby, you know. So she went on to have two more who are now 18 and 16. They're fantastic. And they live in Australia. They live in Sydney.
Oh, wow. Well,
the books, yeah, a lot of things keep me going, yeah.
I mean, this is maybe kind of a heavy question, but, like, what do you make of suffering and hope in life?
It's not a heavy question. I think that it's something that's a really good question, you know. What is suffering? I mean, in my spiritual belief, I believe that, in fact, what I said to my father, I said, everybody gets a dollop of suffering. The whole world suffers, and everyone gets a dollop, and it's up to you to work through your dollop. He found that really helpful because he was so bitter and so upset about what happened to his parents, what happened to his country, what happened to his family, and he found, oh, he could cope with that. Yeah, okay. I can, all I have to deal with is my bit. I don't have to worry about the rest of the world, my bit. And so I think, I just think everybody suffers. You know, I don't think, I was a psychotherapist for 25 years. I never met anybody who didn't suffer, ever. You know, they all had a different twist on the a different set of circumstances, a different set of traumas. Some people didn't have any traumas. I remember one woman in a group I had, she was so happy, but she had mouth cancer when she was like 8. So that was her trauma. She survived it and her parents got her through it. But it was, everybody's got a trauma of some sort.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty awful. And a sense of humour is very good. I have a sense of humour, and especially about old age. My husband and I were just, he acts out being 95. I mean, even though he's only 78, he acts like so funny. And I know I cannot ever be in a nursing home. I watched my mother in the most horrible hospital that was terrible, and I watched my sister in really bad nursing homes in Australia, because, you know, she was already very mentally ill by the time she was in her 20s. And I thought, I never want to be in a nursing home. So we are converting our barn at the front. We're converting it into a house so that we can have carers who live here, because A, my husband and I grow all our own vegetables and fruit. We could not stand eating the kind of food in a nursing home. So we want to teach couple of people on how to grow all the vegetables, how to cook them. My husband's a very good cook. And we don't want to go to a nursing home and eat horrible food and sit in a corner and drool. No thanks. So we're trying to set it up that we have the best old age and the best care that we can. And we're doing it now because we're still young enough.
Right, right. I mean, through all of the you know, experiences of your life. I mean, you know, I'm 35 now, and sometimes I just feel like, gosh, some things, in the darkest moments when things are so heavy, it just feels like, you know, it feels despairing, you know, at times. I mean, I guess I'm just like curious to know for you, like, what was a thing that just like, I don't know, what gave you hope through all the things that were so dark? I mean, your story, just sometimes even just one of those things is enough to make it very difficult for someone's life, let alone all of the things you went through. I mean, how, like, I don't know, like, what kept you going? What kept you hopeful and like positive and still reaching for things that were good when so many things were overwhelmingly dark in your life?
Well, first of all, you're so young, 35, and very, very young. There's a beautiful life ahead of you. Every age. I mean, I remember being 26 when I was with my husband in our flat in Paris with a baby. And I remember this American girl coming around. She was 18. And I remember going, looking in the mirror and thinking, oh, you're so old. She's 18. And I look at her. She's so young and she's so gorgeous. And, oh, you're so old. And blah, 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 blah. And now I look on Instagram at all these women in their 40s and 50s and 60s. They're so young. And they keep going like, oh, we're age defiant. Wait till you're 76. That's what I want to say to them. There is just the thing that age is just a number, but it's not. I mean, when you get to my age and older, because I've watched a lot of my friends get ill, get cancer. I mean, a lot of young people get cancer too, but I can feel it in my bones, you know. Like I still do weights because I have to. I still do exercise, but I can feel my body getting weaker. And in order for me to stay strong, I'm going to have to do more weights. And I'm not sure if I want to, but I will do some. You know, there comes a point where I have to slow down. I mean, I don't think see, you're only 35. You're thinking in terms of you've got the rest of your life ahead of you. I am more than twice your age, and I feel I'm looking back at my life. And I've had it, and I've still got more life, you know. Like for our 40th wedding anniversary, we're going to Prague in September, and I'm so happy to take Jake there and see where I was born, and have that thing. There's always stuff to look forward to. My granddaughter's coming over shortly. I've got the most adorable 2-year-old granddaughter who's amazing. Yeah, so. So I am thinking, I think as you get older, you get a perspective. You get a much bigger perspective of your life. And I think you can only get that when you're in your 70s. I believe
What's that perspective you have?
A perspective is like a view of your life.
Well, I mean, like, what's the perspective you have of your life now that you have it at this age?
I feel a lot more empathetic to myself, a lot more empathetic. I remember when you said earlier, what was that all about? Encounter groups, always screaming at each other and yelling and stuff like that. And I really put it down for a long time. And the perspective I'm getting now that it was really good. It was a good thing that happened. It was very 70s, very much the fashion then. And you watch fashions come and go in therapy, you know, mindfulness. There was tantra a few years ago. And there's all sorts of, now you get a coach. You don't have a therapist anymore. And it's just like you're looking at all these different phases and people. And me, I was so enthusiastic about all my phases. And I watch other people being enthusiastic. But they're just phases and they're just ways of doing stuff, you know, which are fashionable. And so I'm not cynical, but I sort of think that, have you heard of spiritual bypass? A lot of people do bypass this spiritual bypass. Apparently, this is another thing that happened about 10 years ago, is that you think you're spiritual, you've overcome everything, but you haven't. I think you have to keep facing stuff until you die. Facing stuff until you die. And more things come up. And for me, the perspective that's coming up is, hey, that was all right what I did. It wasn't bad. It was really good. You know, I'm not proud of every single thing I did, you know, in those times. But I was doing my best at the time. And I was really helping people, you know. And that's what I was getting the perspective there. And I know why I was helping people, because I couldn't help my mother. I tried so hard to help her, so hard. And I tried so hard to help my sister. I went through it all again. My third sister, you know, sister, well, we had a big, big fight and I've just given up. I can't go on doing all that. You know, I've done my best for my family and you just have to keep going until you die. Yeah.
What do you see as, what do you see as being important?
What do you be important?
I think maybe we don't give enough time to, because, you know, I think when you're young, you know, there's so many things that you're so worried about. But then in the grand scheme of life, like what is valuable and important to focus on?
When you're young, I think you're just so full of a different kind of energy and you think you're going to live forever. And some of the things that I look back on now and have perspective on, I didn't think about when I was young, and I don't see other people thinking about it, you know. I think the biggest thing I've learned is not to be a prisoner of your past. And I see young people as just getting away from it. That's what I did in my 20s and 30s. I was getting away from my family, you know. I was rebelling. I wasn't allowed to cut my hair. And when I was 20 and I ran away from home, I did a Mia Farrow cut. It didn't really suit me. that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to escape the shackles of my life. Then I think as you get older, you have to start facing those shackles, because you become a parent and you do the same thing to your kids that your parents did to you. You know, you have to face. I don't think people want to face that stuff when they're young. And I don't think, that's not true. I mean, when I was 26, I started doing Ngana groups and I found it really valuable. You just have to get to a point in life where you think, well, maybe I am so screwed up, I better do something about it. But I don't think people are screwed up these days. Or they're screwed up in different ways, you know. They're screwed up in different ways, I think. Both my parents and Jake's parents were really, really traumatized by World War II. They took it out on us and we had to deal with it. And unfortunately, it still goes on, like I said before. But I think young people today, I mean, children especially, they're not beaten as like we used to be, you know. They're not bashed about the head and told to shut up and, you know, don't do this, that and the other. In fact, I think they're probably mollycoddled too much the other way, you know. So, but, you know, like some of our kids say, well, why should we look at ourselves and stuff like that? Yeah, why should they? They didn't have a bad upbringing. In fact, we had dealt with a lot of our own stuff, you know. And, like, for example, my mother, she came from starvation childhood. Ukraine was starved by Stalin. 10 million people died, aunts, cousins, this, that, and the other. She was neurotic about food. She used to virtually force feed me, and I wasn't allowed to leave the table until I ate it. And it used to make me feel sick, and I vomited a lot. I could feel. So when I look back, I know there was a trauma in there. There was this starvation trauma, and she did not want me to leave food, you know, because in the 30s, you couldn't leave food, you know. Mm-hmm. So with my children, my daughter, I think about the age of 2.5, didn't want to eat anything. So I thought, so what do I do? Do I become just like my mother?
Right.
Make her eat or whatever? I got a bottle, one of those, you know, baby bottles. I made a very, very big hole in the teat And I used to feed her everything through the bottle. I used to feed her, oats and scrambled up oats and eggs and nutritious things. For 2 years, she drank out of this bloody bottle. And I knew that I had to just leave it, you know. Mm. She got through it. She eats everything now. And her children eat everything now. That to me was a healing. I did not. And then my son, all he would eat was egg and chips for 2 years. So, okay, you eat egg and chips. And I could feel the energy inside me wanting to control them, wanting them to make the meat and not be so stupid, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I knew it was bad. And I could feel me wanting to hit my children. My mother used to hit me a lot, all the time. And that was one of the reasons that I was with men. I used to just give the child to them. You know, they didn't get them. I said, I'm just going to hit her, take her.
They would. Yes, they would. But I mean, just that you had the wherewithal to stop or to be conscious of that is incredible.
It was therapy. That's why I was doing therapy. I was doing a lot of therapy. I was doing, you know, group therapy and private therapy. I was facing this stuff, you know. And I was determined that I wasn't going to keep the chain going. I mean, my mother was terrible with sleep. She used to hit me if I didn't go to sleep. I mean, it was just really horrific. And I have real problems with sleep now. And both my daughter and my granddaughter do have trouble with sleep. But they know the history, and they know just to accept it. And my daughter's husband has to read to her in the night for her to fall asleep. That's a beautiful way of doing it. He's really tired. But it's part of healing the trauma of the past and not being a prisoner of it. Because your children bring it up in you. I mean, Jake and I laugh a lot at our children. What? You're worried? We got four between us. What? You used to do the same to us. Now they're doing it to you. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Revenge.
Oh man. I mean, for the whole, you know, with trauma and healing through that it is so much work to go through that. What is, like, what's your experience of who you were before the healing and maybe after the healing?
After the what? What was
after the healing. Like, what's your experience like as a person before the trauma and then after the healing of the trauma?
Trauma and after the trauma, right, yeah. Well, I had a lot of very tightness in my body. I used to have terrible migraines, really, really bad migraines. And headaches and vomiting, all that sort of stuff. And so by facing all that, I don't get migraines anymore. And I still don't sleep very well, but it's all right, you know. My husband says, it doesn't matter. You can sleep all day. So it's feeling that tightness in your body and dealing with it, what it's about. I did a lot of bioenergetic therapy, which is the theory being that everything is stored in the body. All your traumas are stored in the body. So there's a lot of work you do where you're just letting it go in your neck, in your back, in your head, this, that, and the other. And that's what I did. I was dealing with. I was dealing with what is stored in there, you know, which is, and there's a lot of stuff, I know, you know, and it comes out in talking, in doing processes. I did a lot of gestalt therapy and working on my dreams. Any therapy that you can think of in the 70s and 80s, I did. And now I meditate, and now, you know, yeah, there's, I think my body is a lot more happy than it was before. So,
did you do a lot of worrying when you were younger?
A lot of what?
Worrying.
worrying. Oh, yeah. I worried a lot. I don't worry as much anymore.
Mm.
It was actually hard being a teacher because I was always in front of people and things like that. And I had somebody told me when I was 12 years old that I had stick legs, skinny stick legs. And that's part of the story I tell in Becoming Sexy at 70. I had to go through the trauma of my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to hate walking across the schoolyard because I thought, oh, all the girls are saying, oh, hasn't she got skinny legs? Standing in front of the classroom, hasn't she got skinny? And it was like short skirts in those days. You know, your legs were always on show. And in my 60s, and my 50s and my 60s, I really confronted this thing about my leg. I love my legs now. And if you look on Instagram, I'm always showing off my legs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're gorgeous. I don't know. Why the hell did I think they weren't gorgeous? No. And I realized that if you look down on your legs, they look thinner than if you look across your legs.
Right, right.
Very simple things like that. And then my husband says, oh, you've got the most gorgeous legs. He's very helpful.
Yeah. It's so incredible to hear you talk because I just feel like you never give up. There's never any
I gave up in my 70s. I gave up for a couple of years. It was really bad. I crashed. We got a Tesla. I don't know if you know what a Tesla is.
Yeah.
Beautiful electric, gorgeous car. I crashed it twice. And the first time I hit two other cars and a tree and I could have killed somebody. I was out of control. And then the second time, it's just annoying crashing such a beautiful car. But my husband was amazing. He said, I don't care about the car. I'm caring about you sort of thing. It helped a lot. But I felt like my control was slipping and I felt like, I'm not in control anymore. I can't drive anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. And I really suffered with that. And I went into quite a deep depression. And I got out of it slowly. I still haven't really that happy about driving the Tesla. It's a big car. And, older, things like that are just more scary. They're more dangerous, And so my husband said, we've got a small electric car. Drive that if you're more comfortable in that. And I forget what the last question you asked is, do I ever get really depressed? Yeah, I got really depressed for a couple of years. I got so bad at one point that I said, I think I've got dementia. So we went to the doctor and he said, I'll send a dementia expert around. So they sent a dementia expert. After about half an hour, she said, you haven't got dementia. I said, I still might get it. Can I go on a register? No, I'm not putting you on a register. You don't know what people have got dementia. And so it was like you forget things. I do forget a lot more than I used to, a lot more. So in a lot of ways, I'm pleased I wrote all my books because if I've forgotten something, I'll go back and read it. Really good. Yeah. So I got very depressed about that and I only very, 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 I'm just coming out of it really. My father, he told me this story when he was like a young 17, 16 and the Nazis bombed Ukraine and then went into Ukraine and rounded up Jews, killed them. He hid inside a silo and he said it was really, he heard them all around and he thought they were going to look in, they were going to catch him and all that sort of stuff. So this depression that I felt like I was in a silo with oil on the walls and there was no way I could get out, And I thought, oh, my poor father, he must have felt really, really bad to be inside a silo and have to try and get out. And, it's not easy. But then, my granddaughter comes around. She's two. She's amazing. She really helps me a lot. And she's so beautiful. She loves me. She didn't care about my wrinkles. Didn't care about any of that.
There's something very special about the love of, you know, like a toddler or a baby like that, you know, it's just it's so, so precious.
So accepting. Yeah, we she loves dressing up because I love dressing up. That's what one of the things I wrote about in Sexy at 70. Jake and I went to a lot of parties and made a lot of party costumes. And that's how I spent my 60s, having great fun dressing up. I've still got oodles of party clothes, and I have to get rid of them because I, you know, we went to festivals every summer. I'm not sure if I want to go anymore. And it's all right. It's not sad. But my granddaughter wants to dress up. And so we dress up and we dance. And she's great.
Is there anything in, you know, is there anything that you wish you did that you didn't get to do?
Well, I went through, that was one of the perspective things I went through. My husband is a brilliant physicist and very, very clever and all that sort of stuff. He is really clever. And I thought, well, if I hadn't had a traumatic childhood with coming home to broken dishes every day and teenagehood where my father was repressing me and wouldn't let me go out and do anything, I think I could have studied more and made a lot more of it my intellectual life. You know, I could have been much more brilliant. And then the other day I was thinking about, I thought, hey, you are surviving. You are surviving World War II. You are surviving schizophrenia. You are surviving all that sort of stuff. And by writing this book, Sasha and Olga, and all my books, it's a way of healing that trauma. So I think, well, you know, that's what I was doing. I wasn't becoming a brilliant, you know, whatever. I was doing pretty well, but I was surviving. And I think the proof of the pudding was, you know, writing my books. They're books about survival and how you survive.
It's incredible. I mean, your story is just incredible. I mean, I think the fact that, you know, I think it's just a miracle that you can sit here today and, you know, have so much joy and, you know, you've been smiling so much of this interview and to hear everything that you went through. I mean, it's just no easy feat to be able to now sit on this side of things. Yeah.
But smiling is very important because it makes your English a lot better.
Yeah.
You don't have to look like that.
Yeah.
So I'm very vain. I'm extremely vain. And I always regard myself as being a channel one person.
What does that mean? I don't know if
you've heard of Ram Dass. Have you heard of Ram Dass?
Mm-mm.
He was a very, very great spiritual teacher who said, if you're a channel one person, you're always into how you look and what you're wearing. Instagram is perfect for channel one. But channel two, you're a bit more spiritual. Channel three, you're a bit deeper, you know, stuff like that, and more intellectual and stuff like that. So I'm a very channel one person.
Well, what about like aging and wrinkles and all that? I feel like nowadays, like even there's even, I don't know, it just feels like there's so much. Not only was there's always been pressure, I think, for women to look a certain way, but now we have a lot of like technology and tools to like keep us looking young, so to speak.
Oh, it's terrible.
What's your point of view on wrinkles and aging and skin and all that?
A lot of the people I follow on Instagram are fantastic. You know, they're Twinkle in Your Wrinkle is one of them. That's for one of her names, Twinkle in Your Wrinkle. And I love Helen Mirren. She's older than me, 77, 78, who she just lets herself be old, and it is really beautiful. And I can't remember who said it. I read about this older woman the other day. She said, I'm not going to have a facelift. I'm not going to get rid of these. Every wrinkle here tells the story of my life, you know. Why should I erase the story of my life and look like Kim Kardashian or whoever, you know, whoever the most beautiful young thing at the moment is, probably a lot more now.
Mm-hmm.
Just But I found it hard. I found it hard to own my wrinkles when I was really depressed. I'd go in the mirror and I thought, well, who's going to look at you now? Sort of. And so that's my ongoing challenge. Is how to accept my face, how to accept my wrinkles. And not. I wanted to have a facelift 2 years ago when I was really depressed. And Jake said, if you have a facelift, that's the end of us. He said, I couldn't stand looking at your face and know that you had this and
yeah.
that. Because I was thinking about having this kind of stuff you put in your neck. It's like a thin wire and it kind of, he said, I'd be stroking your neck or kissing it and then there's this wire in there. You think I'd like that? He hates me wearing eye makeup, which I love wearing eye makeup, but it does run. And it just drives me nuts after a bit. And I'm actually quite pleased that my husband doesn't want me to wear eye makeup, you know, because it's much easier. Instagram is full of tutorials for older women. It's a fantastic thing you can put on, like, hide all your wrinkles, you know, do that and the other. And then there's all these other things that you can put which plump everything up. And
right, right. And so that feeling just doesn't go away then.
No, not for me. I'm a Channel One person. My mother-in-law, my first husband's mother, who was like my mother, she died when she was 93. She said, Eva, I don't have time to look at my wrinkles. You know, she had a very busy life and stuff like that. She thought I was mad. Worrying about wrinkles. Come on, you know. And so I think you're either a channel, if you're a Channel One person like I am, I think you always do worry about your wrinkles. But I think other people who've got more depth to them don't.
Yeah. Well, you are a very beautiful person, so you don't need the makeup and all the pulling and the stitching and all that stuff. So
sweet to say so, because I was really tempted. I was really tempted. I
even no, you don't need it. Don't touch it.
It's online, and I thought, oh, I could just go to Turkey and stay there for that. And then I have to think all kind of like that.
That's so funny. Don't do it. It's horrible. You don't need it.
Well, thank you. And that's what is really needed. The cosmetic industry is huge.
It's huge.
The procedure industry is huge. And it's always coming at you on Facebook before Instagram, before and after pictures.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the after pictures. I met this bloke. I went to a party about, 3 months ago, and I met this guy from an Arab country, I can't remember which one, and he was telling me all about his girlfriends who'd had facelift, and they were all awful. And but he was very positive. He said, you don't need a facelift, you know, you just be yourself. You know? But it's like it gets harder and harder if you're a Channel One person.
Well, just to wrap things up, there are two questions I ask all my guests. And the first one being, what do you do for play or for fun?
Right. At least once a week, my husband and I have a party. We put on really good music. We have really fabulous food. And I put on what I call my Russian bar girl clothes. That's always, you know, low cut, show off my legs, of course. And I always do a dance for him. He loved it. And it was when I was 64, I don't know how it came up, but I said, he said, you never dance just for me. I said, okay, I will. So I started dancing for him and I was really embarrassed and I thought, oh, God, he's going to think I look awful or just something. He loved it. He loved it, and he loves me dancing for him, and he encourages me to be sexier and sexier, and that is real fun. So we do have a lot of fun that way. The other way we have fun is food. We eat really good food, really nice food, really drink good wine. We think life's too short for bad wine.
Yeah.
We go to nice restaurants, like when we're going to Prague. We booked 2 Michelin star restaurants for our 40th anniversary, and we try to we went Paris, we went and we had 3 Michelin star restaurants. That was too much. Three Michelin star restaurants. By the third night, we couldn't walk.
Yeah.
So we have fun with good food. Wow. And we have fun with our grandchildren. I try and have fun with weeding the garden. But I do love the project, so we do. And the other thing that I've started to do, because I used to hang around with a lot of people who are my children's age, 50s, older than you, in their 50s, 40s, something else. And I'm just beginning to want to have friends who are my own age. Because they've got the same, they're having the same perspective as me. So we can talk about that, you know. And they were brought up the same time as I was brought up, you know, and they're sort of very, very similar. I was born in the 47. I was a kid in the 50s. In the 50s, we had no TV, we had no phone. On the street, there'd be one car every hour, so we'd play in the streets, you know. None of the doors were locked. We rode bikes, which were never locked. Everybody just came in and out of house. It was such a different time to today. So I've got that perspective. So I'm really pleased I was alive in the 50s because I know what it was like. Yeah. So was that the first question? Have I answered?
Yes, that was the first question. So the last question is, what would you tell your younger self?
What would I tell my younger self? You know, I'm pretty accepting of everything I did. I mean, you know, when I think of my younger self trying to help my mother thought that there was the Russians were after her and they were shining light in the window and they're Australia and they were going to kill her and all that sort of stuff. So I used to do all these things. I used to put little stones all around the window and I used to go and show her all the stones and the next day I'd take her out and said, they haven't moved. If somebody was shining lights in the window, they would have kicked those stones. She thought I was part of the plot, you know. So I did my best. I don't know what else I could have done, you know. In those days, mental illness was really, really shunned. Nobody talked about mental hospitals. Nobody talked about mental illness. There was nobody I could talk to about it. And, you know, I look back and I think I did my best. I really do think I did my best. And I think my biggest thing to the young people is there's always work to do on yourself and to some sort of a practice where you're looking at yourself, you know. I think I, because that's what I did when I was young. I was 26 when I started doing therapy and I think it was really good for me. I think it helped save my children and my grandchildren. And so maybe get a life coach. I don't know. I'm pretty cynical about a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Anybody can be a life coach.
Well, thank you so much, Eva. This was such a great conversation. I just really appreciate you taking the time to share your story. And I mean, even as we're at this point, I'm still just amazed that there's such a brightness to you. And I just don't take it for granted, just like how difficult it must have been, everything you've gone through, and kind of how it's a miracle you're sitting here today and your life today is, night and day.
I got a lot of that brightness from my mother. When she was well, she was very beautiful, funny. And that's what I got from my relatives. They said she was so funny when she was a child. She was always funny. So I think I got that from her. And so I'm grateful to her for that.
Did you enjoy today's episode? If so, please leave us a review and let us know what you enjoyed. I say us, but it's really me. Who would you like to hear from next or what topic you like to discuss? Regardless, I would love to hear from you. Until next time, bye.